It's the 18th of January 2013, and you're listening to The Pod Delusion, a podcast about interesting things. I'm James O'Malley. Coming up this week, we answer the questions. What does Suzanne Moore have to say when she has no statutory underpinning? Is the new atheist church praying for success? Why do clever pharmacists continue to sell medicine that doesn't work? If video killed the radio star, does that also make it a lead suspect in the HMV murder investigation? And is there such thing as too many horse burger puns? Will I finally flip, or will you want me to burger off by the end of it? But before we begin, the begging slot. If you enjoy the Pod Delusion and would like to support what we do, then please do subscribe and donate £5 or £10 a month, or make a one-off donation. All donations are hugely appreciated and help us pay all of the server bills and that sort of thing. You can find links to donate at poddelusion.co.uk. Now, we start the show this week with the Leveson debate, which was held last night at Conway Hall in association with the Soho Skeptics, of which the Pod Delusion is a part. Last night, we saw Dr. Evan Harris and Natalie Fenton from Hacked Off come up against their critics, Nick Cohen and Suzanne Moore, in the debate about the recommendations from the Leveson report. It was a fascinating debate, and you can hear it in full on the Pod Delusion website at poddelusion.co.uk. But today, we bring you some highlights. Of course, the event was all overshadowed by the Suzanne Moore fiasco, which has been going on, which, if you've been on the internet in the past week, you can't have failed to miss. But remarkably, it didn't seem to cause any major problems, and there wasn't even a ranter in the audience like you might expect. So now, here's some highlights. And let's start at the beginning. Here's Chairman Helen Lewis introducing the debate.
Good evening. The Leveson inquiry lasted for 8 months. It cost an estimated £5.6 million. It interviewed 135 organisations, 474 people. We heard 36,000 words from Nick Davis alone. We heard James Murdoch say, "I don't know," 41 times. And like every bit of journalism, it even had a bit copied from Wikipedia. So we're now here going to assess its legacy. The report's been published. We know that there are negotiations going on between the newspapers and publishers and Number 10 about what the recommendations might be. And I really want to talk to the panel about what they think will come out of it. And in fact, whether or not they think anything really of substance will come out of it at all.
The debate got rather heated. So here's a clip of Nick Cohen and Evan Harris really going at it.
Serious journalists who are in journalism for the right reason are very, very worried about what's going on. I wish Sean O'Neill from The Times were here, the crime correspondent, or Sandra Lavelle from The Guardian, because they say to me, the coercive arm of the state, which you want to leak, you want it as leaky as hell. And yes, sometimes they leak about a celebrity, and it's a trivial story. I don't know, I'm sorry for Suzanne Evan, I didn't even read the tabloids. But that is what a free society is like. Trivial stuff comes out and important stuff comes out. And they're saying the whole thing is shutting down. Because Leveson at one point, when we're one of the few people who start trying to raise the concerns of investigative journalists to him, says, well, you know, if you can't have police officers talking to journalists, he says, oh, I've got this wonderful idea. I'll have a police hotline. And if you're a dissatisfied police officer, you can phone this hotline and the complaint will be investigated internally. This is the dream of every bureaucrat in history. Shut people up. Don't let the information leak. You can trust us. The internal structures work.
Evan, can we address that point about sources?
None of that was right, okay? Firstly, there is no attack. None of it was right. Let me give you an example, because there's this talk about sources. There's not a single recommendation, got them here, read it, that has an attack on sources.
You better be right about this. You better be right about this.
Hang on. Just let me finish my point. Okay, so let's take data protection. Okay, because the press are concerned that there may be an attack on their sources. Let's take the one case of I think there were several hundred journalists employing a private investigator and his network in the Motorman files to get private information, health records, driving licences, friends and family phone numbers for thousands of people. Not a single one of them was an arms dealer. Not a single one of them was Jimmy Savile. Not a single one of them was a corrupt politician. Of all these thousands, they were all non-public interest stories which the law was breached and this data was mined and held and probably still held on individuals and lives were damaged. And we know that this information was passed on to people who went to hack. Okay? Now, you just cannot have a data protection regime that fails to protect the rights of individuals to have their information and who they are phoning kept secret from Paul Dacre and Rupert Murdoch.
You say everything I say is wrong.
Okay, hang on.
And you talk about an entirely different subject.
So it's been claimed by Nick and Suzanne that in somehow Haktov want more illegality. If you read our tabloid 120-page consultation and 33 clause schedule 2, it's very tabloid, the sort of stuff that Professor Cathcart, Professor Fenton, Dr. Moore, Professor Barnett come up with. A terrible bunch of tabloidies. If you look at what we've called for more public interest offences, so less illegality, whether it be in libel, or whether where we support libel reform, or whether it be in respect of hacking, where if Jimmy Savile's phone had been hacked by all these newspapers who say they are critical to get to the truth, but never bothered once, even after he died, to look at it, even though they knew, then they would have a defence. Okay, so that's the sort of approach we want to see. You cannot, this is my final point, Helen, you cannot have a system where saying it's all illegal, the police need to do their work better. Okay, because I don't think you should have police in the newsroom. Okay, it's far better that the press are able to regulate themselves so the law is not broken, or where it is on a prima facie basis, there is a clear record of a reasonable belief that the action was taken in the public interest. That doesn't happen at the moment, and the answer is not asking the police to be more proactive on content or news gathering. We need to rely on better independent self-regulation to do it.
Nick.
There's a touch of the tabloid man about effing. Look. Just because it's important, and you said we don't want police in the newsroom. There aren't any news reporters left in the newsrooms. I wasn't talking about data mining. I was talking about Lord Leveson's suggestion that paragraph 2B of Schedule 1 of the Police and Criminal Evidence Act of 1984 be repealed. This is a part of the Criminal Evidence Act that says to the police, if you want, you have to exhaust every other option before you go for a journalist's sources. Now, if that goes, the cops will just say, well, look, Natalie, she's spoken to people we don't like, she's said things, I'm assuming you're a journalist, Natalie. She's probably found some information we want to have. We will go to her first, because it's the easy thing to do. Of course it is. That will mean confidential sources dry up. This is what I said to me about this being such an establishment stitcher, is that if you lose that confidentiality of sources, it's very interesting that Leveson is saying, I'm a moral force on the press. Virtually the only one moral principle journalists have is you go to prison rather than betray your sources. You do anything rather than betray your sources. There's a very fine journalist I'm sure you've heard of in Northern Ireland called Suzanne Breen. And the police service of Northern Ireland came after because she had interviewed the absurdly titled dissident Republicans. It makes them sound like Solzhenitsyn. They're terrorists. But she had interviewed them, and the cops wanted her notes. And in the end, Suzanne was at first to say, look, not just will no one speak to journalists again, my life can be in danger if I hand over these notes. So, you know, be very careful. Be very, very careful of when you hear these cue words, Murdoch, Dacre, responding like Pavlovian dogs, you know, of just going boo hiss. Murdoch and Dacre are yesterday's men. They are a dying breed. But if not, and I fully accept what Evan said, I fully accept what Evan said, that in the hacked off document there's public interest defences in all free speech cases. That's very good. It's not in Leveson. What is in Leveson is a bureaucratic establishment system that will make it far harder for those journalists and, I keep repeating, bloggers, writers, anyone on the net to find out what is going on in the state.
And finally, here's a clip of Natalie Fenton and Suzanne Moore summing up the debate.
What I would like to do is try and bring it back to the reason why we had the Leveson report in the first place. And that does come back to Suzanne's points, very important points, that this was to do with institutionalised corruption at the largest selling British newspaper, that nobody felt, no institution, no politician, no police had the power to hold it to account, right? What we're, not the Information Commissioner, nobody, literally nobody felt they could hold it to account. And at one point last year, we came within, you know, a cat's whisker of getting, you know, the largest owner of newspapers taking over yet more power within the news environment with BSkyB buyout. Now, what Leveson has tried to do
is create a system where that some of that power, not all of it, it's, I agree there are other issues that also need dealing with, particularly around ownership and plurality, but what we have here is an attempt to at least put into place, actually, no, you cannot get away with that anymore. Sure. There will be a system that will hold you to account, and it won't be you holding yourself to account anymore. There will be somebody watching over that.
One institution did hold, and I utterly agree with you.
The Guardian did, yes.
The Guardian, okay. The Private Eye, the press did.
I have to say, in all of it, it was incredibly difficult to get any coverage at all until it got into the point at which Leveson reported, and then it was all anti-Leveson. Up until that point, the majority of coverage on the Leveson inquiry, which was really very press-worthy, news-worthy, was minimal.
It was absolutely minimal. The Guardian and Private Eye, and on the BBC
Guardian
as well, and rightly so.
If you look at it across the board, if you take it most people do, actually.
While I agree with you that Leveson was important, the idea that it would sell newspapers, it was newsworthy. If I was editing a newspaper, I wouldn't have put Leveson on the front page every day because people wouldn't buy it. I'm sorry, it's just a fact. And I would, do you know what? I want more newspapers. I was very sad when the News of the World broke.
Yeah.
I want more bloggers. I want more people to express themselves. The idea of closing things down, the idea of Murdoch pulling Harding out of the Times, closing down his UK operation, which was always the threat, which is kind of happening. He may be Satan, whatever, but I want more stuff. I don't want less stuff. And the result of these people, this incredible puritanical urge to read only what you think, which is like read The Guardian. But I tell you what sells newspapers.
Isn't that your current employer, Suzanne? I think.
Yes, it is for, this week. Does anyone here really understand what sells a newspaper? Can I ask you? Because I can, I know what sells newspaper. And it is not Leveson. It is number one, sports. Number two, astrology. One of the biggest, no, I'm serious, one of the most highly paid journalists in Fleet Street is
Jonathan Kaner.
£2 million a year and another million off the phone lines. The third thing is obviously my column.
And on that note, I think we'll probably bring the first half to a close.
You can hear the whole thing on our website at poddelusion.co.uk. Now, this week we saw the news that Christians are now being persecuted by the European Court of Human Rights, by which I mean a Christian lobbying organisation pushing a victim narrative got slapped down a bit when 3 out of 4 cases weren't upheld. Given that they've escalated this from local level to national and then European courts, I expect that the next stop is the judges at Miss World. One of the cases that you'll have heard of before is that of the marriage registrar who was sacked because she wouldn't perform civil partnerships. Given that this week also saw the government announce the repeal of Section 5, which banned, quote, offensive language, and previously saw someone arrested for calling a horse gay, I guess it means that now you're free to call a horse gay in the pejorative sense if you want to, but if the horse wants to get a civil partnership, if you're a marriage registrar, you have to do it. Anyway, the case that was focused on by the media, of course, was the story of the British Airways employee who was banned from wearing her cross necklace because British Airways hates Christianity or something? I'm not sure. That's not all, though. On the very same day that happened, the British Humanist Association also won an important victory over accessing information on proposed free schools. So it's been a very busy week for them. So to find out more about all of these stories, Liz Luckendorf has been speaking to Pavan and Ritchie from the BHA.
Tuesday was a very busy day around the British Humanist Association offices, as two very favourable judgments were handed down by, in one instance, the European Court of Human Rights, and the other, the UK's Information Tribunal. We've covered both of these stories on the podcast before, but hopefully we have a final resolution for them both. I first spoke to Pavan Dhaliwal, the BHA's head of public affairs, about the judgment handed down by the European Court of Human Rights about the media-emblazoned persecution of Christians. Here's Pavan explaining the ruling.
The ruling was basically a success for equality and for human rights. Four cases were taken to the European Court of Human Rights, which were dismissed in our domestic courts, both at employment tribunal level and then at appeal level as well. Cases were taken which were purely around employment codes of practice and contractual arrangements. But what happened was a whole victim narrative of Christian persecution was spun around them to make them look as if there were four Christians who were being persecuted because of their religious practice, when actually it wasn't the case at all. What we had today was the European Court of Human Rights dismissing three of those cases and finding in favour of one. And it was really an issue of reasonable accommodation for a person to practice their religious belief or practice.
And it's been quite an interesting result in terms of how the media are covering this. As I've been seeing articles in The Guardian and The Independent, BBC, that are like, you know, victory for this person who's been persecuted rather than, well, these other three people lost. It's like, where is that narrative coming from?
Well, the narrative is coming from a small minority of very vocal and very well-funded socially conservative lobby groups. And they are the groups who are taking these cases, who are paying for these cases, and therefore allowing them to go as far as the European Court of Human Rights. And what they've done is managed to keep the detail of the cases which happened at tribunal level here in the UK out of the media. So, for instance, one of the cases related to a nurse called Shirley Chaplin. She was asked to remove a cross that she wore on a necklace for health and safety reasons, because it would have actually put her at risk if she's then bending over a patient and they can grab at her necklace. Now, that's the only detail that you would know of the case within the British media. What wasn't put out in the media was that the NHS trust that she worked for actually gave her the option of wearing the cross, but for her to pin it to her uniform or to wear it on a lanyard. She refused these options and then claimed that she was being persecuted because she was a Christian. With the case of Mrs. Liddell, she was the registrar who refused to conduct same-sex marriages, arguing that it was a matter of conscience. Again, her employer actually went as far as to try to reasonably accommodate her by saying that she didn't have to conduct the ceremony, but she could just do the paperwork and sign the registration afterwards. So thereby she was basically asking to discriminate against gay people. Again, that case was also thrown out. But again, the detail of that in terms of what was offered to her to accommodate her religious belief wasn't brought out in the detail. And the case that actually was successful was that of Nadia Awida, a British Airways employee who wanted to wear a cross on her chain. British Airways, it was actually an infringement of their uniform policy, which stated that no jewellery could be worn. 6 months after that, British Airways actually changed their uniform policy, which would have allowed her to wear the cross. Despite that, again, funded by the Christian Legal Centre, she took the case. And then the last case relates to Gary McFarlane, who was a couples counsellor, and he refused to give relationship counselling to same-sex couples, saying, again, it was a matter of conscience and that he didn't want to do it. What wasn't put out in the media was that when he took that job, he signed the Equal Opportunities Policy, which required him to obviously not discriminate against people. And again, he lost that case on those grounds as well. So the rulings today basically demonstrate that within the scope of a society, a secular democracy, that reasonable accommodation can and should be made for people to carry out their religious practice as long as it doesn't infringe upon the rights of others. And that's the key thing.
These cases have been kind of percolating in the background for at least a year, because I know we've covered the same issues before. And do you think there's going to be more coming up, or will this finally kind of settle the matter?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, I don't think it will settle the matter, because, like I said, these are very well-funded and very vocal socially conservative Christian groups who will want to still peddle the Christian persecution line, which personally I find quite shameful, given the fact that there genuinely is persecution going on of Christians across the world today, for instance, in Syria or in Pakistan. but they want to focus on the UK to the detriment of other minority groups and other people's individual identities. So I don't think this is the last of it. We will continue to see these sort of stories running. But I'm just pleased that today the European Court of Human Rights found in favour of the way that our society operates at a very decent and accommodating level as it is now.
And I guess they still have the right to appeal the case again?
They do indeed. And we only hope that they won't be doing that, because it would be ridiculous for them to do that.
Great, Pavan. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Later in the day, after a flurry of biased and very misleading headlines on the first story, news came through that the Department of Education had lost their appeal to the Information Tribunal on a Freedom of Information request about faith schools. Richie Thompson, the campaigns officer for the BHA, explains the case.
Today being Tuesday, the government has lost a case against us, where the Information Tribunal has ruled that they must publish a list of all groups proposing to set up free schools. And this case originated all the way back in June 2011, when we put in a Freedom of Information request to the Department for Education, asking for a list of all groups who are proposing to establish free schools. We did this because for groups that are unsuccessful, it's currently not known who they are. That information is not put in the public domain, and we think that it's important that it is, because at the moment we only find out who has proposed to set up a school once the government has decided whether or not to back it. And it's very hard to input into the decision-making process if we don't know who these groups are. So in order to increase the democracy in this area and be able to challenge religious schools in particular, having had our Freedom of Information request rejected, then appealed it to the Information Commissioner, who ruled in our favour. The Department for Education then appealed that to the Information Tribunal, and then we had a three-way case involving all of us, today the Information Tribunal has also ruled in our favour.
It was quite interesting. I was reading one of the reports, I think, in The Guardian, about the basically terrible quality of evidence that the Department of Education put forth. What were they arguing with?
It was pretty awful. So the main thing that they relied on in the tribunal case was this survey, where what they did they got the New Schools Network, which are effectively a group that shepherds free school proposals through to success, to contact the successful groups that had, you know, that we knew about that had successfully opened free schools, and say, there's this case going on, your details may be published, do you want this to happen, please respond to this survey. And 50% came back and said certainly not, or maybe not, and then the government used that to conclude that half of the number of free schools that have opened so far wouldn't open. Now, in our response, we spent about 10 pages unpicking this. Flaws range from the fact that the limit on the number of free schools opening is not the number of high-quality applicants, but in fact the budget that's available, through to the point that when they first released this, we could see immediately that it had a leading question, but we weren't sure whether people actually thought, well, what details are these that they're talking about? So we went back to them and said, well, could you provide us with more details? We know that we can see that there were room for people to comment on it. Could you provide us with those comments? And what came out was that people generally seemed to think from the comments that their personal addresses and phone numbers and emails were going to be published and so on. So it was clear that the people responding didn't realise that we were just asking for the names, locations and faiths of the proposals. And the tribunal in its decision today basically said, we cannot believe that a Department of State would use something that is of this poor quality in terms of the evidence provided, and basically said that it was effectively extremely poor and ruled it completely worthless. That was quite satisfying.
So what does this now mean for the faith school campaign? Can the department appeal again?
Yes, unfortunately they can. They can appeal, I think, either to the upper tribunal or to the High Court. And they have 28 days to do so. If they do so, we'll then have a chance to argue that appeal shouldn't be allowed. So we'll really have to wait and see. But unfortunately, we could still be here for a while. If they choose not to appeal, and we're hopeful that they won't, then they should release the information soon. And then we'll all be able to have a good look and see who these groups are.
Very cool. Do you think that there's going to be the same kind of groups backing different schools in different areas? Or do you think it's a whole range of different groups?
In terms of religion?
Yeah.
I think it'll probably be a fairly typical cross-section, in as much as, you know, it is for schools that are open. So, for example, minority faith schools are much more likely to be in cities, that kind of thing. But that's, you know, that's the same for schools we already have. This won't tell us anything new in that regard. I don't think we'll get any unusual surprises there.
Okay, cool. Well, we'll hope there won't be an appeal after this. Rishi Thompson, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We can all hope that more cases like these will be settled sensibly or not be brought to court at all, because they're rather silly. Well, we can all dream, can't we? This has been Liz Luxendorf for The Pod Delusion.
Now, in the 21st century, Britain is a largely secular place. Church attendance has dropped so low that the closest thing we have to a shared ritual is complaining about trains on Twitter. That could all be about to change, though, as two comedians have recently set up what they're calling an atheist church. Sunday Assembly is unashamedly adopting the language and the liturgy of the church, which is an intriguing prospect. To find out more, I caught up with the co-organiser, Sanderson Jones, and started by asking him what inspired him to start an atheist church.
It all came about, it's one of those things where So, and as with all ideas, I never believe anyone who said the idea just came to me. Yeah, there's so many different themes. I've been an atheist for a long time, but I've always just found it is not just, you know, it's not just a non-belief, but it's actually something hugely powerful and only makes the world more wonderful. And all of my comedy shows have slightly tried to end with somehow to give people this feeling of how life is so short, but sort of almost immeasurably amazing, because the fact that you're going to die and then there's nothing. So to me, atheism is in fact just pure joy, and sometimes to a state where it's almost the physical feeling of how lucky you are.
So what made you think, you know, we want to take this feeling and do something and get a congregation together?
Well, that was another thing where let's say when you go to a wedding or you go to a carol service, they're both things which happen in a church. And if you're a non-believer, there's part of them which you really like. You go, okay, just singing everyone together at Christmas. It's not just that Christmas you're at. In a way, it's all the Christmases leading up to it, isn't it? And so there's that sort of tradition. You know, why do people get married in churches? I'm sure so many people of listening have been to those weddings when you're looking at the bride and groom and you're thinking, you guys never go to church, but why is it that they want to get married there? And it's something which goes and makes the whole, you know, it goes and gives it that the sort of moment, that sense of occasion. That, and so, you know, from these various things, it's sort of come about. And then the thing which finally got me going from just an idea, because I've been thinking about it for about quite a few years, was that I started a stand-up show where I sold all the tickets by hand. And I'd also have meetups so the audience could get to know each other. And like, no matter how good a show I'd had, the show ended up being really, really great. But afterwards, someone came up to me and said, I moved to London and now half of my friends I met through Comedy Sale. And there would be this little group, a little ragtag band who would go and meet up. And someone said, Comedy Sale was the first thing I did after I'd broken, ended a 16-year relationship. And now that's so many of my, I've got into comedy and all these other things. And those things we made a genuine difference in people's lives were, and oh God, that sounds a lot. That sounds over the top. You know, stand-up shouldn't be that earnest, but they were really great. And so between all of those things, it sort of came about.
I've seen the video online. Unfortunately, I couldn't make the first service that you put on a few weeks ago.
It's straight to hell for you, James.
But I saw the short video that I can't remember who it was. Someone posted on YouTube, and it looked like it looked as if you were taking almost the evangelical approach with the powerful songs and all that and laughter and that. I mean, did that inspire you? Have you seen the sort of the more fundamentalist wing of Christianity doing all these things and whipping people thinking, I can do that?
No, that's just how I am. So I'm a very excitable chap, and with I think when you start to think about these things, there's a lot to get excited about. So I just hope that our little phrase is, we want to help people live better, help often and wonder more. And just after that first. We now call it a service. It was odd before, we were like event. Before we said event, because we didn't want to say show, because that's our background. But then service seemed too much. But now we've got a bit comfortable with it. What we're going to try to do is make sure that it is sort of evidence based. We make sure that we come up with, we're not trying to tell people how to live their lives. It's more that hopefully it could be useful for you to do the stuff that you want to do. I think that, we don't have to tell people what to believe, because I think the biggest problem that most people feel they face isn't so much their beliefs, but more their actions. I know for my whole life I've wanted to do stuff, but it's me not doing stuff I wanted to do, not me not knowing what I wanted to do.
You wrote a hymn. I mean, can you talk us through what a service entails? Are you actually going the whole hog and doing, hymns, and are you doing equivalent of praying?
Singing together in a group is a great thing. That's why people go to concerts. It's a wonderful communal activity. So we had Don't Look Back in Anger, we had What a Wonderful World, we had Build Me Up Buttercup. There were people just belting it out on a Sunday afternoon. Like when you leave the nave at midday, damn right you've got a spring in your step. Then we had a great reading. And each one's got a theme. So the first one, the theme was beginnings, because it was the start of the year. And so then we had a speaker on that theme, a guy called Andy Stanton. It was also the beginning of the Sunday Assembly, so we could talk about both of them. And what we got at the end, and by the way, it was just rammed. At the end, we got people to leave their New Year's resolutions, and we're going to go and put them up, because the whole thing is, I often think with a New Year's resolution is you've only got so much willpower. And if you try to think about doing it for a whole year, it gets a bit much. So I said, no, what we're going to do is you only have to do it for a month. Pop it up there, do it for a month, come along. I don't know, we're not going to put a gold star there, but whatever happens, I think that's more manageable. Because I know when I failed in the past, you think, oh, but if you just come along and you go, all right, I've done that, just one more. And so that's something which is practical. It's something which is quite simple. Think it's something which will work for some people. And if it does help, then that's great. And so, yeah, you're right. I did have to write an address.
Excellent. And I guess finally, when's the next assembly, and where do people have to go to get there?
The next assembly is it's on February the 3rd, and it's in a place called the Nave. Guys, turn up early, because we have it was absolutely rammed last time. We're doing everything as possible to try to fit as many people in. It's in the Nave, so that's on just off Essex Road in Islington. The theme is wonder, and because I think that if you consider that you're going to die and then there's nothing, just absolute pitch blackness, bottomless, emptiness. I mean, when you start to think about that, then suddenly almost every single aspect of your life should be wonderful. But I mean, full of genuine wonder that you've been given this gift. But why doesn't that happen? So we're going to be talking about that. We've got the CERN particle physicist, who is the Science Museum's explainer in chief of tiny things, who's going to be talking about some of the sort of particle physics science, which makes you just go, wow. And then there's going to be tea. We've got people who want to make cakes. Just to think about it makes it's so exciting. And we are, and oh, the one thing I have to say is that on Twitter, the people go, God, those religious people must have really given it you in the neck. Those Christians must have really. And in fact, that's not the case at all. The hashtag atheist church is just a load of people slagging me off. It's a load of people. I had one person who said, yeah, what you've got to realise is that to most atheists, the word church makes them feel like the word concentration camp does to Jewish people. And you think, really? Does it? No, it doesn't. And so, in fact, it's a lot of people just... And also, I have to add that, you know, we call ourselves a godless congregation. We're really the Sunday Assembly, but, you know, the church is just a cultural signifier so that people can get it. We're not trying to provoke. We're not trying to do anything like that because, yeah, we think there's more interesting things to do. Like, it's more once, you know, once you stop believing in God, let's go and do something positive in the world.
What a lovely place to end, I think. Hopefully your church won't see, you know, schisms with, because I understand you're an atheist and Pippa's an agnostic. You don't want to have, like, you know, a Sonny Shear type situation, I guess.
Sonny and Shear, more like.
But we'll leave that. We'll put links to find out more on the Pod Delusion website. Something that's been fascinating. Thank you very much.
Lovely to talk to you, James.
Now, you may remember that from time to time we have features from Marsh, in which he'll pick apart an obvious PR story in a newspaper, exposing how this so-called news is generated. And usually we can sit around stroking our chins and saying, how stupid. But what happens when a charity uses these same PR tactics to try and promote something that's actually a good cause? And what happens when they get it wrong? Here's Marsh explaining why this charity may need to have a bit of a heart-to-heart with its PR people.
When it comes to pointing out nonsense PR, I feel I'm on safe and steady ground when pointing out how this company or that commercial enterprise is pushing a specific narrative opaquely through the press in order to make money. That always feels neat and tidy. However, things get a bit more morally ambiguous when there's a legitimate and well-meaning charity involved. Take, for example, from the 14th of January 2013 in the Daily Mail, men want miniskirts and low-cut tops banned from the office for being too distracting, and women agree too. Men want hot pants, miniskirts and low-cut tops banned from the office because they're too distracting, new research shows. A study found that at least a third of men want women stopped from wearing revealing outfits at work, with skimpy shorts the first to go. Hot pants were named by 32% as unacceptable, with 30% adding that anything with a leopard print should be banned. Now, it's pretty standard PR fodder, I'm sure you'll agree. You know, complete with the opportunity for eye-catching photographs of women in revealing outfits in the office and a good old-fashioned slut-shaming in the comments, both of which are pretty much the ideal scenario for the Daily Mail. However, the originator of this piece of non-research isn't Superdrug or Debenhams or a dodgy dating website, all of which I'd feel are unquestionably valid targets for criticism when using this kind of approach to grab headlines. Instead, the story was placed by the British Heart Foundation, who were promoting an initiative to get people to wear red to the office in order to spread awareness of heart disease. Quoting the Daily Mail, Polly Shute, fundraising project director at the BHF, added, "It seems the fail-safe weapon at work for 2013 is the colour red. Whether it's a dash of red lipstick, wearing that desirable little red dress, or donning a red tie, organising a Rock Up in Red event is a great excuse to dress to impress with the colleagues. Not only will you have the perfect opportunity to wear a colour seldom seen in the workplace, you'll also help the BHF beat the UK's single biggest killer." Now, this, I feel, is a worthwhile goal. Heart disease is a real killer, and so making people aware of the issue and encouraging the population to support the BHF feels like a nice idea. Yet, it's hard to see the methods the BHF have employed as being anything other than damaging and ill thought out, giving a needlessly negative and judgmental view of a woman's role in the office. Are there no better ways to remind people of heart disease than to call out women for being a distraction to men in the office, who we have to assume that the men are little more than libido machines incapable of being professional in the presence of some exposed skin? Thus, the article managed to be offensive both to women and to men, which already puts the BHF on the back foot with those in the population who identify as either male or female, which, at last count, is quite a high percentage. What's more, this isn't an isolated case, with a similarly poorly judged article back in August of 2011 springing to mind. Quote, "End of romance. One in five married couples kiss just once a week, and then it's just for 5 seconds. One in five married couples don't kiss for an entire week, and when they do, it lasts no more than 5 seconds, a survey has found. Younger lovebirds make more time for romance, with those aged between 18 and 24 saying they lock lips with a partner 11 times a week on average. The survey found only 5% of over 45s manage more than 30 kisses per week." The source was the Daily Mail on the 3rd of August 2011. Now, at the time, the article was promoting the BHF's Kiss of Life campaign, which taught children how to do CPR. Now, I don't think anybody in the world would disagree with the goals of teaching children how to save lives, but it's bafflingly counterproductive of the BHF to promote this campaign by informing married people and couples that the spark and romance of their relationship is dead. Who benefits from such a negative angle? That the 2011 poll, and, if my hunch is correct, this latest poll about women dressing too slutty for the office, that they were product of 72 points prolific manure-spreading polling company OnePoll, merely magnifies this concern. I actually took part in the kissing survey in 2011, and I found the methodology painfully and irreparably flawed. For example, one question simply asked users to choose from a list of options the duration of their last kiss. It was a self-reported answer to a question that nobody is likely to be able to answer accurately. You just had to choose the length of your last kiss from a list of possible options. Yet this became one of the key findings of the article. As a rule of thumb, I tend to lean away from exposing the dodgy data put out by charities to form the basis of articles like these, because generally speaking, charities are doing a tough and worthy job in the face of a harsh economy and severe charity fatigue. But sometimes, the ends simply don't justify the means, and even charities should consider the ramifications of the headlines they're generating. This stuff matters. This has been Michael Marshall from the Merseyside Skeptic Society and bad-pr.tumblr.com, hoping the BHF can do better for the pod delusion.
Now, the new Quentin Tarantino film, Django Unchained, opens in Britain today, and as you can't have failed to notice, it's set in America back when they had slavery, or workfare, as it was known in the 1850s. It turns out, though, that the film is also interesting because it pays tribute to the Italian film industries of the 60s, which is how we got the phrase spaghetti western. It wasn't to do with lassos or whatever, as I assumed, but it's actually a bit of a racial slur. To explain more, here's Alex Fitch.
Quentin Tarantino's Django Unchained arrives with a long retinue of cultural and historical baggage. For the casual viewer and fan of his work, they'll expect the familiar and unfamiliar pop cultural references that his films are littered with, in terms of both visual setup and music cues on the soundtrack. As such, Django Unchained mixes a narrative of oppression, being a thematic follow-up to Inglourious Basterds, with the director's trademark ultraviolence and profanities, especially liberal use of the N-word returning to the lips of his characters following the likes of Jackie Brown and Pulp Fiction. However, as well as the spaghetti western cues by Ennio Morricone and others, which pepper their typically eclectic scores, Inglourious Basterds and Django Unchained, and presumably also the forthcoming Killer Crow, which the director has mooted as the title of the third of his trilogy of oppression, also specifically reference Italian action films from the 1960s and 70s. The first was very loosely inspired by Enzo G. Castellari's The Inglourious Basterds, Quel Maledetto Treno Blindato, while the second is not only inspired by Django, but also can be seen as the latest instalment of the long-running Django saga, which followed Sergio Corbucci's 1966 film. In Corbucci's original film, Django enters the cinematic frame in the form of taciturn gunslinger Franco Nero, who at first ignores the cries of a woman being whipped by Civil War soldiers, but intervenes when it looks like her fate is about to take a turn for the even worse. Settling into a one-street town as the de facto sheriff, a typical western-stroke samurai plot ensues, with a Mexican gang and the soldiers vying over a cache of buried gold, with Django in the middle, playing one side off against the other. Like all spaghetti westerns, none match the quality of Sergio Leone's oeuvre, but Corbucci makes a fair stab of it, making his hero one to remember, from the iconic coffin the gunslinger pulls behind him, concealing an early machine gun, to the casual torture the bad guys inflict on anyone who crosses them. In particular, a graphic ear-severing scene probably stuck in Tarantino's mind long before he considered making a sequel to this film. Other memorable details include a posse of inept Klansmen in scarlet robes, apparently veiled to conceal the ugliness of the extras, according to an interview with assistant director Ruggero Deodato on the DVD, as well as the brutal crushing of Django's hands when he betrays the gang, and the hummable opening title music, which returns intact to the soundtrack of Tarantino's belated follow-up. In the Electric Sheep anthology, The End, I've written about Italy's laissez-faire attitude, or perhaps lascia-caseia, to be more accurate, to sequels. Unlike the many bootleg-stroke-unauthorized follow-ups to successful American zombie movies, Italian homegrown successes also saw a multitude of knockoffs and rip-offs. When Django proved a hit, a variety of other westerns already in production saw their names changed to cash in on the success of the coffin-dragging highwayman. These include Few Dollars for Django, Poca Dollari per Django, co-directed by Tarantino muse Enzo G. Castellari, with its title cashing in on two Italian westerns, Django Spara per Primo, Django Shoots First, and Django Kill, Se Sei Vivo Spara. As you might expect, these vary widely in quality, with the latter, whose title more accurately translates as If You Live, Shoot, particularly worth tracking down as an unusual homoerotic Western horror hybrid. Django Kill's touches of surrealism, Christian iconography, vampire bats, and dreamlike flashbacks prefigure Alejandro Jodorowsky's El Topo, while the graphic disemboweling of a man shot with golden bullets to recover the treasure within anticipate the gore in Italy's imminent wave of zombie and cannibal films in the 1970s. The film's lead character, played by Thomas Milan, is never named, so he might as well be Django, and if so, the film defines his solitude as a semi-mythical figure who claws his way out of an unmarked shallow grave after being left for dead by bandits. After Django Kill, a craze of retitling led to another seven Django films turn up in 1967 alone. But by 1968, Italian directors had had enough time to actually start making Django sequels, rather than naming unrelated films as such. And one of the first out of the gate with some credibility is Fernando Baldi's Preparati la bara, Prepare a Coffin. This prequel-sequel is best known these days for its soundtrack by Gianfranco Reverberi, which was sampled by Gnarls Barkley for their hit Crazy. In Prepare a Coffin, Terence Hill takes on the title role, with Django undercover as a hangman, who uses his new profession as a way of rescuing the innocent at the last minute from trumped-up executions in order to create a gang of his own to get revenge on those who murdered his wife. Although somewhat slow, the neat plot and iconic music give the film some credibility as a bona fide follow-up, and it's nice to see Hill take the lead in a non-comedic western. Another eight Django films turned up between Baldi's film and the following year's One Damn Day at Dawn, Django Meet Satana, Cal Maledetto Giorno d'Inferno, Django e Satana, in which the two iconic gunmen team up for the first of five films, and by the end of 1972, the number of movies that were either made as sequels to Django or merely titled as such had reached the improbable total of 30. By then, however, the entire spaghetti western genre was on its last legs, and apart from other countries cashing in on the success to be had by renaming unrelated films as Django, such as the release of the Nero starring Chioma in America as Django Rides Again, it took the interest of the actor in reprising his iconic role for the 20th anniversary of the original for the name to be properly revived. Django 2, Il Gran Ritorno, Django Strikes Again, sees Django return from self-imposed exile to save his daughter from Hungarian slave traders, and tapping into the zeitgeist, anticipates the following year's Rambo 3, with both sharing monastic anti-heroes, cheesy 1980s production values, and signs of franchise fatigue. Apart from an extended cameo by Italophile Donald Pleasance, whose most underrated film is probably Dario Argento's Phenomena, a.k.a. Creepers, the official Django 2 has little to recommend it beyond the novelty of seeing Nero back in the title role, unlike the next time he'd be seen in a film with a very familiar name. The combination of Luis Enriquez Bacalov's returning classic Django theme, stylized ultraviolence, and Quentin Tarantino attempting an improbable accent he should have stayed well away from, didn't herald the latter's directing of a Django film, but rather his solely starring in one, as the mentor of a female assassin in Takashi Miike's Sukiyaki Western Django in 2007. This film opens with a strange studio-bound prologue in which Tarantino is preparing the titular dish, a stew rather than extruded noodles, over a campfire before taking down a group of would-be killers. 30 years later, with an improbable Japanese accent, he's now the Mr. Miyagi-style mentor of the girl he saved, now grown up to be the protector of another town besieged yet again by warring gangs. And the cultural references fly thick and fast, as Miike mixes the War of the Roses, flamenco, a schizophrenic sheriff in the mold of Gollum, cowboy on samurai action, complete with iconic Gatling gun in coffin, and a small boy caught in the middle who, the end credits tell us, is destined to grow up one day to be the gunslinger Django. This Japanese remix is a heady brew of all that's gone before, marred only by the director's ill-advised decision to have his cast speak English, learn phonetically, which makes the sounds coming out of their mouths as outlandish as anything heard in a dubbed spaghetti western. And it doesn't seem too much of a stretch to assume it was his experiences here that finally encouraged Tarantino to commit his own ideas for the franchise to film. Although racial tension was present in some more of the Zapata-themed Django installments, Django Unchained brings racism to the fore as the major theme of the latest incarnation of the character. Unlike his predecessors, Jamie Foxx isn't cast as another incarnation of the original, but rather plays a freed slave turned hunter under the aegis of Christoph Waltz, playing a mild-mannered bounty killer who trades his search for Jews in Inglourious Basterds to wanted men here. Higher profile casting may bring casual movie fans to the franchise for the first time, in particular Leonardo DiCaprio and Samuel L. Jackson as the villains, as well as long-standing Django fans, since the film features a cameo by Franco Nero himself. But Waltz steals the movie. Foxx, though, is an appealing lead, with nouveau-riche affectations, wearing a bright blue with ruffs outfit for his first trip to a plantation as a free man. Arguably Tarantino's best film since Pulp Fiction, this Django allows the director to combine the tropes of a buddy movie with a western that tackles the racism of the Old West full-on, leading to a variety of uncomfortable moments for the audience where they have to challenge the appropriateness of their own enjoyment as the auteur combines his trademark witty dialogue, gunplay, and absurd characters to maximum effect. Gravedigger, Hangman, Undead Messianic Widower, Orphan Samurai, Freed Slave. The Django franchise has encompassed a multitude of styles, actors, and directors over the past 5 decades, and inspired enough genre-defying movies to make both the most famous installments and some of the least known Django films worth tracking down for at least one element, be it performance, script, music, or mise-en-scène. And these are things that will stay with viewers long after the title character drags his gun-filled coffin into that last western sunset. This has been Alex Fitch, moseying on down for the Pod Delusion.
There was bad news for fans of private sector-led growth this week as HMV, Jessop's and Blockbusters all went into administration, with the internet taking the majority of the blame. I bet it was those online games, all of those realistic business administration simulators that teach young, impressionable companies that over-leveraging their assets and not adapting business models to challenge disruptive products is all fun and games. But when it happens in the real world, real people get hurt. Anyway, this week David Biggins thinks that Amazon isn't the only HMV killer and wonders if it's actually a sign of the death of the DVD.
A couple of weeks ago, I sold off hundreds of my DVDs. Not for much, I only received about 80 pence per disc. But it all added up and I received a nice payment from Music Magpie that's helped to pay off some of my Christmas debts. Maybe I was ripped off. I'm sure some of them would have sold slightly better on eBay, but I needed the money quickly, and sending them all off in one neat package seemed like a lot less faff. All I had to do was go online and type in the DVD's details, followed by my bank account details, and Music Magpie even sent someone round my house to pick everything up. A significant number of the DVDs that I sold off can be watched anytime on Netflix, a service that's pretty much revolutionised the way that you and I consume films. Signing up to Netflix costs just $5.99 a month. If I wanted to, I could also be a Love Film subscriber and only pay $4.99 a month. If, however, I wanted to buy the DVD of Tom Hardy's new gangster flick, Lawless, I'd be debited $11.99 from my account, even if I shopped at the supposedly cheaper Amazon. Now that's more money than both Netflix and Love Film combined, where I'd be able to watch an endless mixture of both old and new films. The maths just doesn't work anymore, and that's also assuming that people are even playing by the rules. A UK survey taken last year by OnePoll showed that over half of UK citizens download films illegally. It seemed ironic to me that both HMV and Blockbuster should go into administration during the same month that I'm several hundred DVDs lighter, but strangely I don't feel a sense of loss about anything. I read in an article in the Metro this week that quoted Luke Lewis, the outgoing editor of NME, saying, "It's definitely the internet that's killed HMV, but that's not necessarily digital downloads. That's just people buying everything from Amazon." Channel 4 News agrees with him, highlighting that HMV were squeezed by internet retailers and supermarkets, whose scale had enabled them to offer CDs and DVDs at cheaper prices. Now, I'm dubious about any article that attributes HMV's failure to Amazon or Tesco selling cheaper DVDs. Being undercut was certainly a factor in HMV losing sales, but I think this view misses the bigger picture. Fresh data from the Entertainment Retailers Association shows that while spending on digital entertainment rose by 11.4%, proof perhaps that piracy isn't killing off all sales, physical CD and DVD sales fell by an evidently HMV-busting and Blockbuster-busting 17.6%. Projected Blu-ray sales, on the other hand, which HMV always had a poor selection of, are up 21.3% year over year. We're not looking at the death of the high street DVD retailer, we're looking at the death of DVDs. I mean, if online retailers are really killing off the high street, then why on earth are John Lewis, Dixons and Argos doing so well? I've been thinking about it for the past few days, and I genuinely can't think of the last DVD that I've bought. Aside from the popular Netflix and Love Film options, I tend to use the free BT Vision streaming service, where if I'm really desperate to watch a film, I'll pay a small fee and download it on iTunes. For anyone that follows me on Twitter, at Real Whispers if you're interested, will know films still matter to me a great deal. DVDs, however, have slipped out of my life. A couple of my friends have said that I'd regret my impulse selling spree, but if anything, I've found the experience quite liberating. It occurred to me, while I was typing out barcode after barcode, that I haven't even watched most of them in years. I'll admit that I did experience a vain thrill when visitors who came to my house let out a gasp at the sheer size of my collection. I became known for it. This is David. You should see the size of his DVD collection. I only paused for thought when it came to selling the first DVD that I'd ever bought. Ghostbusters. The experience of watching it is one of my clearest memories. I'd chipped my tooth at school while playing rugby when I was 13. I'd been sent home early so that I could see a dentist. Fortunately, my dad was one, so I just went home, really. Upon arriving home, I noticed a brown cardboard package sitting on my windowsill from play247.com, which later rebranded as the cleaner play.com. At the time, my house didn't even have a DVD player, so I had to play it on our computer's DVD-ROM. I slipped the DVD into the family PC and watched ghosts being busted in front of an awkward, square, 17-inch computer screen. It wasn't exactly a comfortable experience. The computer was housed in a small room, on a small desk, and there was only a cold metal fold-out chair to sit upon. As the computer screen wasn't widescreen, what computer was back in 1999, the entire film was displayed in letterbox format with giant black bars looming over the top and bottom. None of this stopped the viewing experience from being one of the most incredible of my life, right up there along with seeing a film in IMAX for the first time. I'd sat transfixed for the whole 2 hours, hypnotised by the clarity of the image. There were whiz-bang sound effects that I'd never noticed before. Lines of dialogue that were once previously obscure now sounded clear. There was so much more of the image to appreciate. I'd only ever seen Ghostbusters with its sides hacked off and with the image desperately panning and scanning from left to right in a hopeless attempt to follow the action. Now the mere positioning and movement of the camera seemed meaningful. After the film had finished, I watched it again with its audio commentary. Then, one by one, I made my way through all of the special features. Behind-the-scenes documentaries, trailers, split-screen before and after special effects comparisons. A spell was cast upon me so thick by this multi-layered magical multimedia that I even watched it in German with English subtitles. The memory of Venkman saying, "Ich bin geschleimet," I've been slimed, still makes me smile. The mad compulsive consumption of everything on a DVD wasn't reserved for just Ghostbusters. I scrutinised every little nuance of my early DVDs, and I bought as many as I could, and not just from online. Visiting Virgin Megastores so that I could pick up 5 DVDs for just £30 became a monthly ritual. I'm still partly convinced that Virgin went bust just because they changed their name to the awful Zavvi. I was buying DVDs so early in their existence that I actually owned DVDs that had to be turned over halfway through watching the film because you didn't have dual layers originally that could store the extra data. Goodfellas springs to mind as an example. These days, however, it's incredibly rare that I'd choose to watch the special features on a DVD or even a Blu-ray. The last enjoyable DVD documentary that I can recall was from The Return of the King, the special edition, and that was 10 years ago now. I'd always considered CDs to be doomed when MP3 players became popular. I was slightly ahead of the times, owning a Creative Movo in 2003. At the time, it could store a whole 64 megabytes of MP3 data, which was actually less than a CV and hardly a threat to HMV, really. However, in the last few years, Apple have been selling an iPod that's advertised as being able to hold up to 40,000 songs. Now, I don't condone piracy, however, let's stop to think about this for a moment. On average, it costs 79 pence in the UK to download from iTunes. Therefore, in order to fill an iPod Classic by downloading through iTunes exclusively, consumers would need to spend £31,600. For a student or a teenager, this sum is unthinkable. They're just not going to pay it, and you can hardly blame them for searching for other means of acquiring music. I'm certain that there's going to be many people who passionately disagree with me, so please tweet at Real Whispers with your views, that's R-E-E-L. However, for me, with falling sales in DVDs and CDs across the market, HMV's business model was no longer sustainable. I believe that their time had come, really. I'm now just left wondering what's going to happen to all of their stock. I can certainly recommend a good website that'll help them flog it all quite quickly.
Now, there were some long faces at Tesco's and other retailers this week when it turns out that decisions about what to put in some of their burgers had been made on the hoof, and horse meat had turned up in beef burgers. You know, as if it was the main course. And as you might imagine, this has been controversial. The Irish food inspectors have been a right old nag and said, "Nay, this isn't good enough." But at risk of being accused of trying to stir up trouble, I'm not sure I can see what the big deal is, though I don't have that much experience with horses. Though I did once take a horseshoe fitting exam. I nailed it. I guess it's because I'm a vegetarian. But isn't horse meat supposed to be posher than cow? Why are people angry about free horse meat? It's free horse. You could say a gift horse. You're looking a gift horse in your mouth, in the mouth. It turns out that I'm not the only person who thinks this way too. And maybe jockeying others to agree with me might not be so tricky. Here's Sean Ellis, explaining why he doesn't really see what the big deal is.
Did you know that hamburgers is an anagram of Shergar bum? No? Well, you do now. And you probably also know that this is a rather timely anagram, as Tesco this week discovered that horse meat was present in some of its burgers. And the whole country went doe-eyed and drippy about the lovely little ponies ground up for burgers. Is there any justification for this? As a sceptic, I thought about it, and I can only see two problems with it. Warning. The following piece contains graphic descriptions of how delicious animals are. Vegetarians may want to spin forward a minute or three. Before I talk about the problems, however, let's see what's not wrong with it. We have no reason to believe that the horse meat in question was in any way injurious to human health. above and beyond the usual harms to human health that occur from eating too many burgers and sitting in front of the telly for too long. Many cultures around the world eat horse with no apparent ill effects at all. And are horses really that different from many other animals we already eat? I don't think so. They're vegetarians, like most of the other animals we eat. I personally don't eat any meat that's from a predator species. If you like, I'm a vegetarian. And we eat some pretty weird things. I bet you've had some squiggly sea weevils recently. You know, what do you call them? Lots of legs, big underwater bug things. Prawns, that's it. So it can't be a weirdness factor when we're prepared to scoff antenna-wielding alien horrors from the abyss with wild abandon and Marie Rose sauce. You may say that we feel empathic bonds to horses, as they are social animals. But then, so are cows and sheep. And the majority of us shed few tears when it's time for Daisy or Flossie to keep our appointment with a bolt gun. And if we're worried about their supposed intelligence, and anyone who's watched a horse laugh at you after deliberately throwing you off will attest to this, then again we have a contradiction. Because pigs are much more generally intelligent than horses. Yet a bacon butty is still A. delicious and B. uncontroversial. I think the main thing is that many of us have interacted with horses, either as working animals or as pets of our own, if we have the spare acres and cash. We don't eat our pets, as a rule, as we build up a deep bond with them over a lifetime and value them for companionship over utility. They become another member of the family, and people who eat members of their family tend to end up on the news, not in a good way. So we can empathise with the loss of a horse as a pet in a way that we don't with a pig or a chicken. I haven't mentioned chickens up to now, but by the way, they're simply evil. Even if it's not our own dog, cat or horse, we can see that the loss of a family pet is a tragedy for all concerned. But these horses weren't pets. They were bred and raised for meat. Our sympathy here is misplaced. There simply isn't a good, rational reason to single out horses as worthy of tears and grief while we chow down on a KFC bargain bucket. I always found that odd, by the way. Try our food. It's so appetising, we serve it in a bucket. But I digress. As far as I can see, there are two good, sane, rational reasons to object to horse meat in burgers. The first is food labelling. Food labelling regulations are there for a good reason. People are allergic to all kinds of things, and someone with an allergy to horse meat could have been made seriously ill. Allergy to particular meats is pretty rare compared to nut or wheat allergy, but it's not completely unknown. Food labelling also allows us to trace ingredients, to check for disease and animal welfare standards. We don't know if these horses came from a nice farm with a lush field, enjoying the horsey equivalent of the good life until the fateful day, or whether their conditions were less humane. Even us meat-eaters are generally concerned that suffering be kept to a minimum. And this really brings me on to my final point. I have to address this as a problem that faces me as a supposedly evidence-driven person. I don't need to eat meat at all. The evidence is abundant that a vegetarian diet is better for me, better for the environment, and more sustainable than eating meat. I eat vegetarian at least some of the time, and I find meals without meat just as delicious and filling as my regular fare, just different. And yet, sit me down in front of some crispy shredded chili beef, and my Neanderthal ancestry reasserts itself with vigour, and before you can grunt, "Tasty mammoth," I'm tucking in. And you can guarantee that if it was crispy shredded chili horse, appropriately sourced and labelled, of course, then I'd almost certainly do the same. This is Sean Ellis, wondering what most of the fuss is about, for the Pod Delusion.
And that's just about it for this week's show. If you have enjoyed this week's show, do head over to our website at poddelusion.co.uk, where you can find over 3 years of archives and, fingers crossed, listen to the entire Leveson debate in full. You can also like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter if you're into those sorts of things. That's all at poddelusion.co.uk. And while you're there, please do subscribe and donate £5 or £10 a month, or make a one-off donation. All donations help us keep making the show week in, week out. So you can find links to donate at poddelusion.co.uk. The Pod Delusion this week was brought to you by Liz Luckendorf, Chris Chapman, Elizabeth Donnelly, Michael Marshall, Alex Fitch, Eon, David Biggins, Sean Ellis, and me, James O'Malley, with additional editing by Liz Luckendorf. The sketch in the moment is by David Lovesey and Brian Too. The Pod Delusion is a partner of the British Humanist Association. Thanks for listening.
Evening, Justin. Usual?
Oh, yes, please, David.
Pint of Guinness and a packet of pork scratchings?
Actually, I don't eat pork anymore. It's against my faith.
Your faith?
Yeah, that's right. My faith as depicted by my cross.
Cross?
That's right. La cross that adorns my neck. A symbol of my faith.
Oh, I was going to ask you why you're wearing a long stick with a net at one end round your neck. I get it now. This is one of your little scams, isn't it?
How dare you say that? That's typical of the oppression I've come to expect from this country.
Really? So when did you discover this new type of faith? Was it quite recently?
If you must know, yes it was. I had a road to Strasbourg moment only this week.
This wouldn't have anything to do with that woman winning her case at the European Court of Human Rights for the right to wear religious jewellery after being suspended on full pay and then winning a further €6,000 in compensation?
No. Well, might be.
You haven't been big on details, have you? Because if you had bothered to see the pictures, they showed quite clearly that the lady in question was not wearing a long stick with a net at one end, but a small silver cross.
I'm taking no chances, mate. I've got the full motley.
And that's why you're wearing full vestments of crozier, mitre and gaiters?
If that doesn't get me suspended from work on full pay, I don't know what will.
Justin, you work as the Archbishop of Canterbury.
Oh, bollocks.